Welcome to Believe is Questionworthy. Nice of you to listen in today. The first chapters of the Bible cause a lot of controversy, even among theologians. And I'm very happy that we can talk today to one of the, or maybe the leading theologian when it comes to the Bible creation story. Today's guest is John Walton. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah. We would like to get to know you a little bit. And yeah, I hand over to Hannah, who is John Walton.
Yes, it is a great honor to introduce you today to our audience. You were born in the United States and you have a bachelor's degree from Wheaton College in Biblical Studies and a PhD in Hebrew and Cognate Studies from Hebrew Union College. You are a former professor of Old Testament, also at Wheaton College, and a former faculty member at Moody Bibles Institute for about 20 years. You are an expert on Old Testament studies, especially on Genesis, which is also the topic today, and on ancient Near Eastern context of the Bible. And yes, you advocate for understanding scripture through its original cultural lens instead of our modern lens today. And yes, you have publicated a lot. Some of your key publications are something like The Lost World of Genesis 1 or The Lost World of Adam and Eve. And you're also a contributor to the NIV application commentary from Genesis. And you are a frequent speaker at conferences and seminars, and you are widely recognized as the world's leading expert on interpreting the Old Testament. Yes, and it's great to meet you today, and we are so honored to have you here.
Thank you. That was very nice.
Yeah, was it always a favorite topic in your life to think about the first chapters in the Bible, about Genesis?
It has been a long-standing interest since even my college days.
And we've just heard that you are widely recognized as the world's leading expert on interpreting the Old Testament in the light of ancient Near Eastern cultural and literary contexts. And you have set international standards in this field. So you are the right person to ask. Why would you say, John, is it so important to understand the Bible in its ancient cultural context rather than just reading it through our modern lens?
I think mainly it's because in every communication, there are underlying cultural assumptions that contribute sort of silently to the meaning, things that are common knowledge between the speaker and the hearer or the writer and the reader, and that don't have to be said, but that everybody recognizes. And so in that sense, it's very important for us to understand any of those elements that are looming behind the communication that's taking place in the Bible. And likewise, with our own cultural context, there are meanings that linger behind that we don't want to bring into it. So cultural assumptions contribute to meaning. And we're interested in reading the text in context. If the text has any deep interest as a text itself, whether theologically or academically, we want to know what it had to say. And that means we need to study it in its context. That means I can't just indiscriminately read it through my modern lenses. I don't go to the book of Proverbs and expect it to talk to me about social media. I don't go to the book of Kings and expect it to discuss democracy. And I don't go to Deuteronomy and expect it to discuss capitalism and modern economic systems. Likewise, I shouldn't go to Genesis and expect it to talk about modern science. We want to read what it had to say on its own terms, in its own culture, through its own language. So that's the rationale for trying to read it in its cultural context.
And would you say it is more difficult in Genesis because the text or the cultural is that ancient and it's not that recent like maybe the Greek culture in the New Testament?
Yes, certainly Hebrew culture is further away in time and further away in nature than our own culture. So it does make it more difficult.
Maybe on the other hand, if we put so much weight on the ancient Near Eastern background, maybe that puts us at risk of letting those old worldviews dictate what the Bible is even allowed to say.
Well, it's not really the worldviews that dictate it. It's the authors that dictate it. The authors are the ones that control meaning. It has to be that way. And if they are speaking from their culture, then what they intend to communicate, again, both spoken and assumed and unspoken, is what we need to take account of. So this isn't letting ancient culture dictate. It's rather recognizing the ancient culture that's inherent in the biblical speakers. The authors dictate the meaning, and they're in the ancient world. So whatever they assume from the ancient world is part of the meaning that we need to recognize.
And as I understand it, you argue that Genesis 1 isn't meant to be read as literal as a modern style account. It's rather a piece of ancient cosmology. Before we get into the Genesis text itself, could you explain what exactly you mean by that? And are there other examples of this kind of literature?
Sure. So first of all, let's think about that word literal a little bit. I don't know that I would argue that it isn't meant to be read literally. When I use the word literal, and I think when most people use it, they mean that you want to understand it the way the person speaking or the person writing meant it to be understood. That's literal. So, for instance, in the Bible, if something's a parable, it's a literal interpretation to read it as a parable. If something's a metaphor, it's a literal interpretation to read it as a metaphor. I always want to read the text for what it intended to be. So when I look at Genesis 1 and think about the modern ways of reading it, to me, those aren't literal because they're not trying to think about the author's world and the author's culture. They're rather putting our culture on top of it and our literature on top of it. So in that sense, a modern style account runs a much greater risk of violating a literal reading. Literal depends on understanding what they were trying to say and tracking with that. In terms of other examples, well, cosmology just talks about kind of our understanding of the nature of the cosmos. Sometimes we would say it has to do with the origins of the cosmos. Technically, that would be cosmogony or cosmogony, I guess with the German, cosmogony rather than cosmology. Cosmology is just the study of the cosmos and the understanding of it. We have plenty of texts from the ancient world that do that sort of thing. This is a book of Sumerian cosmogony and anthropogony texts. This is a book of Egyptian texts. This is a book of Babylonian texts. We've got plenty of literature from the ancient world where we can see them interacting with these kinds of ideas, trying to understand the world that they're in and how that came to be.
Now, maybe a little bigger question. What makes you confident that this is the right way to read Genesis 1? What convinces you that this ancient cosmology approach fits the best?
My only confidence comes from a sense that I'm tracking with the author. That's my obligation. That's my accountability. I want to read the text on its own terms. So my confidence is in that sense that I'm getting what the author is intending me to get. So in terms of ancient cosmology being the right way, well, what are the alternatives? To totally neglect the ancient culture and just plop our own on top of it? I don't know that I could be very confident about that, because then how would I be respecting the author's intentions? It's the author's intentions and my ability, as best as it is, to connect with those that give me any confidence. When I talk about interpretation, I would say the strongest interpretation is the one with the strongest evidence. Now, the level of evidence varies greatly depending on what it is that we're talking about, but I can only feel confidence when I feel like the evidence has piled up considerably and that allows me to draw conclusions. My end goal is not to be confident. My end goal is to be faithful. And that means I can only kind of do what I can do to try to understand the evidence, whether it's linguistic or literary or cultural or theological or historical, to understand that evidence as best I can.
Would you say it is an important question who is the author of the text? Because I think there's a discussion. I'm not nearly an expert on this, but whether it was Moses or it was someone else, or maybe many authors, is that important for you and for your account?
No, it really isn't. Thanks for asking that. It's not really that important because they're Israelite. Whoever they are, they're Israelite. And therefore, that leads me to think of an ancient Israelite context, whether it's early or late in the biblical period, or maybe some mixture of them, depending on the way the traditions developed and the way texts were written. We can't identify who they are. So if it depended on knowing who they are, we wouldn't be able to say anything about them in the Old Testament. Even the prophets, we can feel confident that it was the prophet who spoke, but the prophet is unlikely the one who put the book together. So even there, the author is different from the speaker. So no, it doesn't matter if we can identify who they are, but we know that they're Israelite, and so we can think in an Israelite frame.
And you say, if I understand it right, that God created the material world before Genesis 1. But the text doesn't seem to say that clearly, at least not for the average reader. And I think most Bible readers today would never pick that up. So how do you justify that reading?
Well, first of all, I would kind of like to think about that concept of before and after. The idea of God creating the material world before assumes that this is supposed to be an origins account. And most readers assume that it's an origins account. And I've come to think differently. In our modern ways of thinking, origins are important questions for us, especially when it comes to scientific kinds of thinking. But that's our cultural world that frames things that way. I think for Israel, it's more important to think about the identity. What is the cosmos? Who makes it work? What's its purpose? Those are much more fundamental questions for an Israelite. So I don't know that they would even think in terms of, was the material before the, you know, the account that we have? Because they're not thinking, I don't think, in before and after terms. They're thinking of how things have been since the beginning, and that's where it starts. But in that sense, it's really talking about identity, not origins, the way we might think about it. But in terms of would readers pick it up, you know, I think with a little attention to the text, even modern readers could pick that up. When you get to day three, it talks about God calling forth the dry land to emerge. You say, oh, it doesn't say that he made the dry land. Now, if it's there, he obviously had to make it some other time. But the biblical text isn't really interested in the when or in the sequence. It's just talking about how things were ordered. That's the terminology that I favor. God is ordering the world. And so the dry land emerging, dry land is where order takes place. The sea is where non-order. And so the dry land order comes into the midst of non-order. And then all the setting up order is then focused on that dry land. And so in that sense, it assumes that the material world exists because there it is. It's there, and it didn't talk about God making it. He just brought it forth.
I think you said it once, it is a home story, but not a house story. Is that right?
Yes, that's one of the analogies that I use. A home story, not a house story. Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't you say that it is necessary that God is also the one who built the house?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, again, this isn't a theological question. It's a literary question. Theologically, neither I nor Israel would have any doubt that God is the one who created the material world, built the house. There's no questions about that. When the Bible talks about God laying the foundations of the earth, that's a material statement. When it talks about him spreading out the heavens, that's a material statement. But they don't have a material story. They have those material statements kind of scattered here and there, one-liners. But when they want to tell the story, they want to tell the story about ordering. And so that's a literary question, not a theological question.
Right. So, yeah, I think that is helpful that you just say it's not in the text itself, this theological statement.
Right. They get to determine which story they tell. And we have to try to take that on its own terms.
And I think from your perspective, when it comes to Adam and Eve, I think there it becomes controversial for a lot of people, for many people. Would you think that Adam and Eve were real people? And would you place much more emphasis on understanding them as archetypes than as historical individuals?
I put a lot of emphasis on them as archetypes. And that's not, in my view, that's not just my choice. I'm trying to track with the authors. Whatever's important to the authors is important to me. That's what goes along with it, with taking the text on its own terms. So I could ask all kinds of questions. I could ask what color was their skin. I could ask whether they had curly hair or straight hair. I could ask all kinds of questions, but if they're not the questions in the text, then they shouldn't be important to me. And that includes the question of them being individuals, because I think it's very clear that the text treats them as archetypes, that is, representatives of all of us. And in that way, as I read the text, I'm thinking that I am them and they are me. We are them. We are they. There we go. So in that sense, it's not a them and us kind of thing. It's not, well, they were this way, but we're this way. So it's not trying to distinguish us from them. It's trying to identify us with them. So our question shouldn't seek out everything that we might wonder whether they are. Our question should be focused on everything that the author wants to say about them. And so that's why I put this emphasis on archetypes, because in my view, and of course it's an opinion, I think it's backed by evidence. After all, their names are archetypal. His name is humanity. Her name is life. So I think in that respect, there's evidence that that's what the text wants to do with them. And I'm just trying to follow the text.
And would you think it is a mistake if we now jump to Romans 5 and compare Adam and Christ, or Paul compares Adam and Christ? And there it seems, or I think some argue that then Adam seems to be a real person because his sin has real consequences in this world. What do you think about these?
Well, certainly sin has real consequences. And I'm certainly very eager to read Paul when I'm reading Paul. But I'm not interested in reading Paul when I'm reading Genesis. I want to know what Genesis is doing with him, because I'm not just tracking with Paul. I track with Paul when I read Paul. I track with Genesis when I read Genesis. So the discussion of what Paul thinks of Adam, that's a separate discussion. It's an important discussion. It's a complicated discussion, but that's one that you have when you're dealing with Paul. I'm trying to unwrap Genesis in Genesis's own terms.
I think that's a typical thing that we tend to jump into everywhere in the Bible. And I think also when it comes to science and Genesis, and there are some accounts who try to bring those worlds together. What do you think about these discussion? I think there's a book from Joshua Swamidas where he tries to bring it together, and William Lane Craig has an approach where they discuss the scientific world and also Genesis. Is it something where you think that is too bold, or is it too much? Or what do you think about these accounts where we try to bring these things together?
Well, I've already talked about the idea that I don't want to read modern science onto the text as if that's what it's talking about. And that's not what Craig and Swamidas are doing, but that's what some people do. And I don't want to do that because, again, my modern lens is different from what an ancient cultural lens would be. What Swamidas and Craig are both doing is that they're trying to fit together science and the Bible. They're trying to find how maybe the gears mesh, and they can say, oh, Adam represents this or that, genealogical Adam, or, you know, some ancient Homo sapien Adam. So they're trying to integrate science and the Bible. I'm also a bit cautious about that. because if I truly believe, as I do, that the Bible is not being scientific at all, then I have no reason to think that those gears will mesh. The compatibility that I believe exists between science and the Bible is not a compatibility of being able to intermesh the gears. It's a compatibility that comes of recognizing what the Bible is doing and what it's not doing. And I don't think it's providing a platform where we can kind of plug science into it.
Yeah, thanks for unpacking that. In your interpretation of Genesis, you give the Garden of Eden a special role. Can you unpack that for us? Why is Eden so central in your view?
Well, I'm not, again, so sure it's central in my view. I want to recognize how it fits into the view of the Genesis author. The new book that just came out of mine, New Explorations in the Lost World of Genesis, reflects some change of mind on my part with regard to what's going on with the Garden of Eden. Previously, I had thought about it as God coming to be present in the human realm, and that there he was setting up his presence among people. The slight change that has taken place is that I've now become convinced that rather than God coming into the human realm, it's humans being brought into the divine realm, and that therefore this represents one of the ways that people think about how order can be achieved. That is, would there be order in the human realm if they could only live in the divine realm? If we could only do that, then everything would be wonderful. And I think that here the Garden of Eden account brings out the recognition that, no, that would have its hazards, that would have its difficulties, that actually is not very conducive for human existence and order. And so that gives it a little bit different place. So I don't know that I'd call it central, but it's an important scenario that the text opens up, and we need to try to understand the significance of it.
A common objection to your view would be that Genesis 1 never explicitly says anything about a temple. But you call your view a bit of a temple reading. So maybe you can tell us a little bit more about that. And also, what are your reasons to read the text in that way?
You're absolutely right. It doesn't use the word temple. And even the word it uses for rest does not immediately push us into a temple context. Now, that's something that I worked out again in some of the chapters of my new book. So what's going on? To me, it's a matter of cultural association. So in our context, in our world, when we say a worship or a sermon, we don't have to say the word church. We automatically recognize that that's talking about a church context. That's a cultural association that we very easily make and hardly even realize we're making it. But worship and sermon are words that really don't operate outside of the sphere of church for us. So that's an automatic. And I suggest that the same thing is true when in the ancient world, they talked about divine rest. If they talk about divine rest, there's no other options. There's no other alternatives. It's an automatic connection that they will think about temple, because temples were built for gods to rest in, and gods rested in temples. And so in that sense, that's an automatic cultural association. Now, the reason why it seems difficult to us to make that connection is because that's not a cultural association that we make. And that makes it more difficult. But that's how I would explain it. So to me, it's clear that an Israelite would have thought that way. But it's not clear in the actual words of the text because it's there by cultural association.
Is that something that is different in the Bible creation story, if we compare it to the Sumerians or maybe the Babylonians?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, it's exactly the same. They all connect divine rest with temples. And in fact, temple building is often connected to cosmology accounts and creation accounts.
I think a thought that I've heard often in different approaches when it comes to Genesis is that this approach sounds so complicated, at least for us. But God doesn't work that way. He wouldn't reveal eternal truth in a way that requires studying ancient cultures to understand them. How would you respond to that?
Well, one off-the-cuff comment, maybe a little too snarky, is that, are you saying God wouldn't reveal it in a different language? He did reveal it in a different language. And that therefore, that requires us to do some work. Now, in that case, many people have done the work for us by providing translations. Okay, but you can't say God doesn't do that. He did do that. He revealed it in a different language and in a different culture. To us, it sounds complicated because it's not our language or culture. To an Israelite, it wasn't complicated at all. It was their language, and it was a cultural that they understood. The cultural background was native to them. And so in that sense, I don't know that we would be correct in saying that God doesn't work that way. It's very clear that he did. The fact that that makes it complicated for us is just a given. No matter what culture God communicated into, it would make it difficult for other cultures. No matter what language he communicated in, it would make it difficult for other languages. He could have chosen to do it over and over and over again in every language and every culture, but no, he didn't. And there's no reason to think that he should have. So in that sense, yes, it creates some complications for us, but that's the way it is and we have to work with it.
Yes, thank you. Maybe that brings us to a more deeper question. If Genesis is so deeply rooted in an ancient worldview, what does that mean for how you understand divine inspiration, and how can a text like that still be God's word for us today directed at us?
Well, the line that I use in almost all my books is that the Bible is written for us, but not to us. And so I fully believe that the message that God spoke through those human authors into that text, even though it was in their language and their culture, their historical setting, that once we understand what it meant to them, that we believe that continues to have relevance, a message from God for us. Divine inspiration isn't based on whether I understand it or not. Inspiration is the quality that it has as coming from God. And it came from God in through those human instruments, whether they're the Israelite ones or the Greco-Roman ones, through those human instruments. And therefore, that text, just as 2 Timothy says, that text is what's inspired. And that text still preserved today, translated so that we can understand it, therefore still carries a message from God. As long as it's translated well, as long as we interpret it with accountability. And so that message remains important to us. Now, we still have to try to figure out what that message is, but we take it as God's word, has a message for us from God, and there are differences of opinion sometimes. But it continues to be God's message because it continues to tell us what the author wanted to tell his audience. But we have to make that connection. What's it saying to them? What does it mean to them? And then what does that mean for me and for us?
I think for some people, your interpretation of Genesis 1 is challenging, especially if they grew up in a certain traditional view. Why do you believe that this different approach doesn't weaken faith in the Bible, but actually strengthens it?
Any way that we can approach the Bible that gives us a better understanding of its authoritative message has to be stronger. And I believe that we have to take account of the language and have to take account of the culture in order to read well. And the more we can feel like we're connecting with what the author intended to say, the stronger our interpretation will be, and therefore the more significant the message will be to us. You know, there, for many people who have been raised in traditional view, they're well aware of friends, at least, if not themselves, who felt at some time that that traditional view became incoherent with the world that they knew, the science that they were exposed to in university or whatever it might be. And we know the statistics are very clear. People who are raised in that traditional view, they're high numbers. I'm sure it differs how high they are, of those who have left the faith because they found that when they were told they had to choose between science and faith, they eventually came to the point where they believed that the science was convincing. And therefore, well, if I have to choose, I guess I have to give up my faith. As a result, we have plenty of young people who have turned away from their faith or lost their faith in some way because the traditional view did not cohere. Now, when I look at the view that I present, maybe there are statistics I don't know about, but I don't know of anybody who's losing their faith because they accept my view or because they've been raised in my view. So it doesn't weaken their faith. It gives them a reason to hold on to their faith. It gives them a reason to believe that they can hold on to their faith and accept the mainstream science without conflict. So I promote a non-conflict model. And I don't see people losing their faith over that. Maybe I'm not looking at it at the right angle. I don't know. But in that sense, I would say that it gives people a foothold into a compatible worldview, a coherent worldview. It gives them permission to believe scientific models if they're convinced by them and not feel like that's going to be a threat to their faith or their belief in scripture.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. I would like to ask one final question. Maybe here are some listeners in this podcast who never read Genesis 1, or maybe they've read it once, but not really find some worth in it. What would you say is a real treasure in this ancient text?
Real treasure is found in the message that it intends to give. And its message is that God is the creator. And by that, we mean that he is the agent who has brought about creation. It doesn't tell us how he did it. It doesn't give us his mechanisms, except that he spoke and it happened. Whether it spoke and it happened the next second or he spoke and it happened in the next 5 million years, it doesn't make a difference. God is the agent. And even if evolutionary models reflect accurately how things came into being, there's no contradiction there. God could work through that kind of process if he chooses to do so. And so the thrust of the biblical passage is that God is the agent of creation, regardless of what mechanisms we might find or what other mechanisms he might have used that we haven't found. God is the creator. Now, as creator, the other gem in the passage is that as creator, God is the one who made the world work the way that it does with a purpose. And that gets to what I called order. So we're not so much interested in the material origins. We're interested in the order that God has brought about. Order is the highest value in the ancient world, as far as I can tell. And therefore, the one who brings order is in the principal position. Think about when you go to work at a new place. Is the first day of work, you sit down at your desk and say, show me the architectural plans for this building so that I can really know what I'm doing. Or do you ask, show me the organizational chart so I know who I report to and who signs my paychecks and who I'm working in collaboration with, right? We've overemphasized the material aspect and raised it to a higher level of importance and priority than it really deserves. In the ancient world, they didn't really think much about the material side of it. They knew it was there, but that just wasn't the story that interested them. They want to know who's in charge, who makes it work the way that it does, and what are his purposes. And those are the gems in Genesis 1. We can reflect on the same kind of thinking when you think about your computer. If you've got a laptop and somebody asks you about your laptop, you probably won't talk to them about the chips on the motherboard or about the polymers in the screen. you're more likely to talk to them about your apps and your operating systems. We're more interested in order and function and the way that it works and its purposes than we are in the chemicals and the chips. Apps are more important than chips, although we know the chips are important and the thing can't run without them. So that's an example in our own day where we can see this distinction. So I think we have to read Genesis 1 and 2 and 3 through ancient eyes instead of through our own modern glasses. And that's what brings out the real theological punch to these passages.
Dr. Walton, thank you so much for this talk today, for your thoughts, and also for your work in your books and through the internet. Thanks a lot. I think it's a great treasure for many Christians, but I think not only for Christians. Maybe there are also other people who get an eye-opener through your thoughts. Thanks a lot.
I hope it helps people.
If you have any questions to this episode, please let us know through our usual channels. We are very glad to hear what you think about these thoughts today. So we wish you a nice day. See you soon. Bye-bye.